been intensifying its airstrikes across Yemen and killing more civilians, including children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to launch further operations deep inside the kingdom. Yemenis believe that the army has the right to hit back at those killing Yemeni women and the children and violating the sovereignty of their country. They say Riyadh should come to realize that the more attacks it conducts against Yemeni civilians, the more painful retaliatory strikes will be carried out against Saudi facilities. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
French President Emmanuel Macron didn't give a press conference until more than 2 years into his presidency, but he gave a two-hour televised interview shortly after the publication of the first poll, which shows him losing in the second round of the April election. The primary of the mainstream conservative party recently selected Valérie Pécresse, a former budget minister under Nicolas Sarkozy, and a new poll has her beating Macron 52-48 in the final round.
The traditional conservatives are bouncing high in the polls, thanks to the buzz from being newly united around a single person. They've lost a lot of votes in 2017 due to their candidates' perceived corruption, but with a restructured party and message, the rumors of their total demise may have been premature.
In 2017, the conservative candidate, François Fillon, was disgraced by a tremendous scandal over fake jobs, and yet he still almost made the second round. Many say the poll is a reminder of the historic strength of the mainstream conservative party, and also of Emmanuel Macron's almost permanently low approval ratings.
The one thing this poll makes clear is that Pécresse will at least be among the top three candidates of the first round. For her to advance, she really needs the support of Marine Le Pen to crumble and also to attract many of Macron's dissatisfied voters, but it's too early to say if that will happen.
Pécresse hasn't come out of nowhere, but few expected that she would be in this position. She's often considered the conservative most similar to Macron, so a Pécresse-Macron final round won't offer many arguments in terms of policy. In the interview, Macron rejected his nickname, President of the Rich, but also promised that his re-election will bring right-wing changes to pensions that could cost him with older voters. He repeatedly admitted that he has made mistakes in his comportment, but not in his policies, and claimed that the corona pandemic made him more sensitive to the needs of the average person. Many said the interview appeared like a campaign speech, but Macron has still not yet declared if he is running for re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turkey's central bank voted to lower the interest rate of the country once again from 15% to 14%. This has directly affected the lira, which reached a record low of 15.5 right after the announcement. The Turkish lira has lost 50% of its value against the US dollar since the beginning of this year. In a trial to drag the attention of the public from the drop in lira value, Turkish president finally announced the raise in minimum wage after long negotiations between the government and opposition. Tayyip Erdogan said the increase would be 50%, making the minimum wage 4,253 Turkish lira.
The increase in minimum wage is 50%, the highest raise in the last 50 years. I believe that with this increase, we have shown our determination not to crush our employees in the face of price hikes.
Analysts refer to the public anti-government protests, saying people are complaining from the price hikes, the drop in lira value and inflation. However, instead of controlling the prices and solve the lira problem, the government chose to raise the minimum wage, which business owners are not very happy about, since they are already not meeting ends due to the economic situation in the country.
The increase in the minimum wage solves the problem just for right now. But if the inflation will keep staying higher like this, then in the long term, in a couple of months, the raise in the prices will eat the raise in the inflation and people will get poorer. Then it is for sure they will react against the AK Party in the elections. This may be the end of Erdogan era. What Erdogan hopes, they will not only increase their minimum wage, but they will also control the inflation. by more production, by more export, then they will also control the value of Turkish lira, then the inflation rate.
Investors and economists have been calling for the government to increase interest rates. However, it seems President Erdogan is sticking to his new plan, saying higher interest rates will worsen inflation. Analysts believe that the current economic crisis may put an end to Erdogan's era if he doesn't control the situation, especially now that both the ruling party and opposition are preparing for the elections. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Islamophobia is everywhere, making news on a regular basis. From the U.S.,
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
To the halls of power in Europe.
Do I have a problem with Islam? Yes, I do have a problem with Islam.
Recently, this made headlines. Lauren Boebert joking about meeting fellow Congressman Ilhan Omar.
I look to my left, and there she is. Ilhan Omar. And I said, well, if she doesn't have a backpack, we should be fine.
Muslim minorities everywhere are discussing solutions to the crisis. At the Islamophobia Awareness Conference organized by the Islamic Human Rights Commission based in London, the panel asked how much Muslim minorities can engage with their non-Muslim governments without compromising their faith.
Is our position one where we should engage in a kind of pragmatic way to just the ends justify the means? Or rather, do we follow, for theological reasons, a principled approach?
I would say, from my perspective, it's vital for diasporas, Muslim diasporas, the Ummah across the world, African and Caribbean diaspora, you have to engage.
Muslims are often forced to pledge allegiance to Western values in an overtly violent way. This is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. So refusing to do this can be powerful.
The depoliticization of mosques and the younger generation is a major concern. Efforts to prevent young people seeking justice and fighting oppression have intensified, raising the alarm.
There is a deliberate attempt to social engineer a type of Muslim which will not speak out, will be just obedient servant, will fit into the second class citizenship which we all know is being promoted.
We asked conference moderator Professor Saeed Khan why such events matter.
Conferences like this are ones that help to then map out what is then not only the condition of Muslims, but to try to then understand where and how we place resources and strategies moving forward.
The far right is growing across Europe, manifesting in anti-immigration policies, bans on the Islamic dress code, and encouraging anti-Islam sentiment via the media and digital spaces. So these discussions have to be had if stereotypes targeting Muslims are to be confronted and deconstructed. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In the limelight.
On Friday, 10th of December, a devastating swarm of tornadoes swept through Kentucky. The state's leading figures appealed for federal aid, which was promptly granted, and rightly so. Helping people and communities in need is what nations are supposed to do. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, who is also a distinguished professor at City University of New York Graduate Center and has won the 2008 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. The article is titled, Kentucky on My Mind. Stay with us for the New York Times op-ed. Friday, 10th of December, a devastating swarm of tornadoes swept through Kentucky. The state's leading figures appealed for federal aid, which was promptly granted, and rightly so. Helping people and communities in need is what nations are supposed to do. Observers couldn't help noticing, however, that some of the Kentucky politicians asking for aid, notably Senator Rand Paul, had in the past not only opposed aid for other disaster-struck states, but sneered at their pleas. What should we make of this hypocrisy? The truth is that it runs deeper than aid for me, but not for thee. Remarkably, if you look at how the federal budget affects U.S. regions, there's a consistent pattern in which conservative states that preach the importance of self-reliance are in fact heavily subsidized by liberal states, especially in the Northeast. The Rockefeller Institute publishes regular estimates of states' federal balance of payments. The difference between the amount the federal government spends in a state and the amount they collect in taxes. In Virginia and Maryland, a lot of federal spending consists of the salaries of government workers. Elsewhere, however, it is mainly Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, plus some military spending. Topping the list of net beneficiaries was, yes, you guessed it, Kentucky, where residents receive an average of $14,000 more from Washington than they paid in taxes. To put this in perspective, Kentucky's 2019 net inflow of federal funds, $63 billion, was roughly 30% of the state's gross domestic product that year. Economic geographers often interpret regional economies using the base multiplier model. The idea is that what drives a local economy is its export base, the stuff it sells to other places. The income generated by that export sector in turn supports jobs in local services and healthcare, from healthcare to restaurants. The economy of New York City, for example, is largely driven by the financial industry in New York. The money earned there, directly or indirectly, supports most of the city's other jobs. So what is Kentucky's export base? Not the traditional industries. In 2019, the state, which has more than 4 million residents, had fewer than 6,000 coal miners, while the distillery industry, which to be fair has been growing, employed only about 5,000 people. On the other hand, more than 250,000 Kentuckians worked in healthcare industry and in social assistance. And who do you think paid for a lot of that? So, in a real sense, Kentucky's economy lives on federal dollars. And that's okay. The main reason Kentucky is such a large net recipient of federal funds is that the state is relatively poor. It is in a region that has to some extent been economically stranded, as production and wealth concentrate in large, highly educated metropolitan areas. As a lower-income state, Kentucky receives the full benefit of federal programs like Medicare, but pays relatively little in income or payroll taxes, so it gets much more than it pays in. And that is actually how the social safety net is supposed to work. We want individuals who, for whatever reason, are hurting financially to receive support from the more fortunate, which necessarily implies large transfers from rich states like New Jersey to lower income states like Kentucky. What's not okay, though, is when states that are huge net beneficiaries of progressive taxation and a social safety net preen and posture about self-reliance and the evils of big government. It's even worse when they assert some kind of moral superiority over the metropolitan areas that pay their bills. I mean, it's amazing that we're still doing the thing where small towns and rural areas are held up as the real America, where politicians from, say, Montana are still lecturing urbanites that they need to get out of the big cities. Yes, it would probably be a good thing if more New Yorkers had a sense of what life is like in Montana. But how many Montanans have a good sense of what life is like in Queens, which happens to have twice Montana's population? Not that Queens is the real America, or at least no more than anywhere else in this nation. We should see ourselves as one nation, and it will be nice if people in places like Kentucky both accepted that and acknowledged how much they benefit from being part of a greater whole.
Are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Freedom seems to continue to be more and more limited in a country like Britain. A Conservative MP says the British government will make it illegal to participate in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement next year. Now, this basically means that, similar to many of their American cousins, Brits will not be free to choose to boycott the racist apartheid entity of Israel in the same way the global civil community was able to boycott and pressure the former apartheid regime in South Africa until it fell. What does it all mean for freedom of choice in countries which profess to believe in democracy but show themselves to be quite authoritarian, especially when it comes to Israel?
Alarm bells have rung across Britain after a Conservative MP informed pro-Israel activists of new government plans to outlaw the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. The comments were said by British lawmaker Robert Jenrick during an online conference about anti-Semitism titled "Why Do So Many People Hate Jews?"
It is, I think, becoming much more of a fringe activity. What we want to do is pass a piece of legislation here, and I'm pretty confident it will be in the next legislative programme, the Queen's Speech, as we call it.
Since 2005, the boycott campaign, also known as BDS, has sought to sanction all Israeli-made products produced on illegally occupied Palestinian lands. The movement has been so successful in causing economic damage to Israel that pro-Israel groups have branded the BDS an existential threat and attempted to smear its supporters as anti-Semitic.
It's a shocking decision from the humanitarian point of view, where once again the British government is standing by the oppressor, is standing by the occupier, is standing by the criminal against the victim. It's something that it doesn't surprise, but it shocks us to the how tone deaf this government is. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if anything, this government has stupidly, foolishly, ridiculously, has actually afforded far more credit to BDS than it could ever have imagined.
This development would be just the latest example of a long line of attacks that this government has carried out against Palestine solidarity activism since it came into power. If they go ahead with these plans next year, then we can expect to see large-scale protest and condemnation action taking place from the many supporters of the Palestinian cause up and down the country. Robert Carter of London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mostafa out of London. And lawyer and BDS campaigner Blaine Coleman out of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. I'd like to start off with Hafsa. I mean, the conservative MP exposed plans by the government during an online conference that they would be making illegal to participate in the BDS. I mean, what is your perspective about this if it really happens?
It's difficult to say. I don't think in practice it will impact the act of boycotting Israeli goods and events, because obviously people are entirely free to carry out those boycotts and they are free to refuse to purchase goods that were produced illegally and in a country that violates human rights law and oppresses the Palestinian people. However, I think it's the act of promoting those boycotts that becomes illegal and therefore becomes problematic, because of course pro-Palestinian organizations are reliant on this technique and in order first to promote the Palestinian cause and also to push for more rights of Palestinians through peaceful means. Now, of course, many of us have been saying that we shouldn't have been putting all our eggs in the same basket by concentrating exclusively on BDS, because of course resistance to Israeli oppression needs to take various forms. But of course, for Palestinians, every single form of resistance is demonized, is turned into an illegal act, and even something as peaceful as boycotting Israeli goods, or rather goods made in occupied Palestine, becomes something demonized and becomes illegal. So I think it just reinforces the idea that there are many influential and powerful lobby groups that will act and will use any means possible to pressure and destroy the Palestinian resistance movement. But of course, on the plus side, everything that they do actually reveals the heinous and demonic aspect of Israeli policies and Israeli supporters.
Okay. Well, let me get Blaine in on this. Blaine, your perspective. I mean, you're sitting in the U.S. in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And, of course, we know that in the majority of U.S. states right now, there have been attempts to make, participating in BDS illegal. How has it affected the BDS movement there, or has it affected it?
Well, Marcia, first of all, I'm really glad you're back in action. Second of all, yes, the BDS movement in the U.S., I believe, has not been affected by these silly laws. And as the other guest rightly mentioned, in the United Kingdom, I don't think the BDS movement is going to be seriously affected by these stupid laws either. And the reason is because, in my opinion, what counts with this BDS movement is having people marching on the ground in their city councils demanding action against Israel. And, you know, you don't have to demand boycott against Israel if for some reason they actually outlaw it, which I don't think they're going to do, but if they really do that, you can do what we do in our city council in Ann Arbor. I don't know if you can see the sign here.
Yes.
We hold this sign up at almost every city council meeting that we can get into that says we are against military aid to Israel. Now, how are you going to outlaw that? In the United States, it's impossible to outlaw that. In the Constitution, it says you can petition your government for the redress of grievances. And in the United Kingdom, I think similarly, they would not be able to outlaw someone going to the city council in London or Bristol or anywhere with a sign like this. It's impossible.
Okay.
So there's more than one way to skin a cat. You can demand boycott if it's legal, if somehow these idiots illegalize it. You can demand an end to military aid to Israel. Now, in the UK, you can demand no more military equipment to Israel because the UK sends a lot of military equipment to Israel. So these stupid laws are not going to stop anything. The one thing that will stop the BDS movement is BDS activists who imprison themselves in social media and who won't get to their city councils, won't go to their student governments, and won't publicly demand action against Israel. That's the only thing that can stop the BDS movement.
Okay. Well, Hafsa, your take on this. I mean, in general, what does it say about a country who tries to make it illegal? Because according to Blaine and yourself, you don't think that they can be effective in actually stopping this movement. But the fact that, for example, the United States and the United Kingdom seem to be actively trying to stop this, participants in the BDS. I mean, what does it say about the countries themselves?
Well, I think it says that they're completely beholden to Israeli interests. But can I just pick up on a point raised by the other panelists? I would love to agree and say that it won't really have much impact, but I think it depends how the new laws are going to be worded. So if it's worded in the sense that it's a hate crime and it's racism, then in the UK, at the very least, there are risks for activists to be even imprisoned. Now, I think that the US laws actually on free speech are much more open, and I think that there is far greater freedom of speech in the US than in many European countries where, for instance, you have laws that literally you can be imprisoned if you question certain aspects of the Second World War, if you question certain things about various, you know, even Armenian genocide in France, for instance. You know, if you don't abide by what the French have agreed, then you can actually be imprisoned for up to 5 years. So it really depends on how the politicians will word their policies, and that is actually quite alarming, because if they make it out to be a hate crime, then there are risks for Palestinian activists to be imprisoned should they promote BDS. Having said that, of course, in answer to your question, I think it really does reveal that these countries are very much sliding towards dictatorships, and we don't really need the BDS to be aware of that. I think the imprisonment of somebody like Julian Assange, for example, is an example of how much freedom of expression, of how much democracy are eroded in these countries who are lecturing other countries about about things such as freedom of expression, such as human rights, and who actually, on their soil, are not applying it. We have seen that somebody like Julian Assange has literally been rotting away in prison for many, many years simply for revealing and for doing his job as a journalist and as a whistleblower, and he's been imprisoned. So imagine somebody who supports the Palestinian cause can face something similar. And I think that what is happening is these laws are being introduced precisely to scare activists and to make sure that they abstain from supporting the Palestinian cause. Of course, the upside of that is that people are also now more and more aware of the nature of Israeli policies, and therefore they're waking up, and therefore they're resisting it. So I think it's a sort of balance, but I do think it's actually rather worrying, in particular in European countries and in the UK.
Right. Well, Blaine, isn't it interesting that countries like the United Kingdom and the United States, that a citizen is freer to criticize their own countries than they are to criticize Israel? This is quite mind-boggling. Your take on that, what exactly does that mean? Okay, we seem we have lost, we've lost Blaine. Hopefully we'll be able to, I have you, Blaine, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure both of them.
Okay, it seems that we're having some problems with the connection. So I'll pose that same question to you, Hafsa, until hopefully we will reestablish that connection with Blaine. I mean, what do you make of it? It is rather bizarre that you can criticize your own country more and inside of that country than you can another entity.
Absolutely, and I think that we rightly saw, I think it was a Palestinian teacher who took the Texas to court because she wasn't allowed to practice the BDS. And so in the US, it's very bizarre that you can criticize your president, your government, various authorities, but it's considered illegal and hate crime or racism or whatever it is that the lawmaker seems to have come up with regarding Israel. And I think it really reveals what Donald Trump has said just last week in a recent interview, that actually Israel controls the US Congress. Now, what happens is that because Israeli lobbyists actually can pay, literally can pay a U.S. congressman to be at their service, they have invested enough money to buy themselves each a U.S. congressman, and therefore what is resulted in is it is the Israeli government that actually controls the American powerful authority, which is the Congress. So in essence, through their money, they have these congressmen who, rather than work towards the benefit of the American people, for the American people, introducing laws that benefit the American people, they're actually working solely to benefit Israel and the Israeli government. And this is why, for instance, they will hesitate in introducing laws to provide decent health care, free education, and all those things that other governments take for granted. However, they will always vote in favor for large sums of money being devoted to the Israeli government and the Israeli war machine. And this is something that is very astonishing for many people outside who cannot understand how they vote for politicians who are more committed and more devoted to a foreign entity than to their very own people and population.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting what you just said, Hafsa, because it would appear, I mean, when we're talking about, even talking about the possibility of this taking place in the UK next year, I would think that British citizens should be outraged at the possibility of, even, you, although you said it's not going to have an effect, but even that the government would think that they could do this, which, of course, they have done or tried to do in many American states. Do you think that we would see some type of blowback from the British people in general? Because it's not really just talking about here the Palestinian cause of BDS. It's also the weeding away of their individual rights.
I think it's difficult because the UK culturally has a very apathetic population that very rarely takes to the street and imposes its will on governing authorities. It's been sort of conditioned to accept the rule of law and authority and very rarely question it. Remember, this is a monarchy, this isn't a republic, and it doesn't function in the way many old democracies function, whereby people take to the street to ask for their rights. They are literally conditioned to accept what the politicians often tell them, and it's very, very, very rare, in fact, to see protests, mass protests in the streets. And sadly, when you do see protests in the UK, they're often very demonized in the mainstream media, essentially, which is dominated by a right-wing press that considers that any street protest is some sort of savagery and is uncivilized behavior. And even when they do protest in large numbers, in any case, the authorities, for instance, completely ignore. So you'll have one major example, which I think many Britons who are listening tonight will remember, was the opposition to Iraq in 2000s, literally taking that war. Now, the only thing that Tony Blair did was appreciate that it was an expression of freedom of expression, of course, but in essence, it had absolutely no impact because it didn't change his mind. It didn't change his policy, despite the consequences and despite the opposition to that conflict. So, well, is that people seeing that their protests do not result in any meaningful action have literally simply abstained from reacting to any of these policies. And it's very sad. And of course, because there is a social condition that has been deteriorated, for instance, you're seeing the NHS, that the health service that isn't very well funded, you have schooling that is deteriorating, you have transport that is deteriorating, you have people that have far more pressing issues rather than actually take to the streets to require more rights.
Okay, say what we have. Blaine, hopefully we have a better connection. Can you hear me, Blaine?
Yes, Marzia, perfectly.
Okay, great. Blaine, I mean, on a regular basis, when we look at what's happening to the Palestinians being killed by the Israeli regime or being maimed or neighborhoods being taken over, their homes being bulldozed, crippling siege, of course, on Gaza. I mean, with all of this being said and everything that is happening, we always see that this is downplayed already in the corporate media, mainstream media. And now we see these governments trying to actually coerce their own citizens basically to keep quiet, not to say anything. I mean, this seems like a total different level of going towards authoritarianism. I mean, I want your perspective on the direction that these so-called liberal democracies or countries are going into.
Well, Marcia, I guess I don't have too much time to complain about them. You and I have seen this for many years when it comes to Israel. And again, like I say, there's nothing to stop us from talking. Now, there is a good side to this attempted repression by the U.S.
Okay, we've seen we've totally lost Ann Arbor and Blaine, unfortunately. Well, Hafsa, he was talking about that he thinks that it is having an impact, though. He made an interesting point that actually, when the Zionists are making so much noise and there's so much attention and they're attempting to silence anyone or an entity, it does say something that it has them running scared and it's having an impact. Your take on all of this, the impact that you think that BDS has had on affecting the Israeli regime and what needs to happen from here?
I would agree. I have to say that, you know, if this didn't have any impact or if this didn't affect Israel in any way, then they wouldn't be investing so much effort in going after it, in lobbying so many governments to legislate against it. So there's clearly an effect. I don't think it's impacting, in essence, the Israeli economy as such, but I think it is having an effect on public bias that for many defend. They've been fed a certain narrative on the Palestinians and on the Palestinian resistance movement, and they're now through something as very and peaceful as refusing to buy goods is being demonized. That is having an effect on public opinion, which realizes that, in fact, the baddies in this story are the Israelis. Because, of course, for almost 50, 60 years, many people had been believed that the baddies were in fact the Palestinians, who were only resisting the occupation of their land. But now, because of all these efforts, so bizarrely, it's self-destructive for Israel in the long run, because they're showing their real faces and they're showing the nature of the Israelis by going after the most peaceful and the most innocuous form of resistance and policy making. So I think then yes, this has a very positive impact on the long run. Sadly, in the short run, it's going back because it's going to deter many from embracing the Palestinian cause. It's going to scare many people away. But on the other hand, it will reveal the Israeli policy's actual nature. And I think that slowly but surely will actually start eroding the influence on Western governments and Western policymakers.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you, Hafsa Karim Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London, also lawyer and BDS campaigner Blaine Coleman out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And my apologies, viewers, for some technical difficulties during this spotlight, but we appreciate you all being with us. And make sure you join us right tomorrow for another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
In the limelight.
Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic, but melting of permafrost means mass death. Stay tuned for more. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia fill leaky boats or trudge overland in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the East and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This male vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding. While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California, and Canada, a far more serious threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century, destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Linden called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. And achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hotspots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday Report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. By mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academies of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land and expands 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5% of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive DeWayse Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.